You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Earlier this week, Governor Tony Evers announced a clean energy plan for Wisconsin.
It lays out a list of strategies for achieving goals that will help Wisconsin adapt to and mitigate the effects of climate change.
That includes the target of 100% carbon-free electricity by 2050. Among the other goals, reducing the state's purchases of energy from other states by developing more in-state sources for power and increasing the use of renewable sources. That plan sets goals, but to put many of them into practice, the state legislature would need to sign off on changes.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What is your top priority for energy in Wisconsin? Where should the state be focusing when it comes to energy policy? What should we change, and when should we change it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org.
Fred Beach teaches energy technology policy and international energy policy at the University of Texas, Austin. Fred, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
A lot of states, Fred, have plans of one sort or another to promote renewable energy, to manage their energy grids and more. First of all, can you talk about the role of a state government in setting these kind of priorities for the short and long term?
Actually, in the United States, they're pretty limited. We live in a representative democracy. So most of the voting we do is not so much with the ballot box to get our representatives in there, but it's what we do with our wallet, our pocketbook. Our strongest votes are our actions within the marketplace. So the government can set goals, and the legislature can pass laws that restrict things or encourage things. But it really comes down to what I think the consumer does that matters the most.
Well, if consumers are listening, and I assume most of us consume energy one way or another, what kind of influence can they have as consumers on the energy mix in their community?
I guess by speaking up with their actions. Many of us have the opportunities, depending on our electric provider, to get lower emission energy sources or purchase those. Most of us who have single family homes obviously have the option to put solar panels on our roof or to control the type of heating and cooling we do in our homes, which is influenced by the energy source. And then, of course, there's transportation, which is a whole other sector we can influence.
There is as a fair amount a state can do when it comes to regulations to make it easier or more difficult to do things like, you know, encourage wind or the rooftop solar you just mentioned. What kind of examples would you point toward in states that you think are doing these things well or poorly?
I think one of the strongest things a state can do, and a few states have done, is deregulate their electricity market. Obviously, California did that quite some time ago and went through a lot of learning pains in the process. Texas followed a few years after that, learned from California's mistakes, and other regions have followed. Deregulating the market, giving the market more power, and therefore the consumers more power, I think is a strong step in that direction. I think that is something certainly that the state could do if they chose to, but it'd be a pretty bold move.
You wrote a few years back about Texas's growth in renewable energy sources. Can you talk about the kind of things you've seen there and what you think has helped that happen?
You know, Texas is interesting. We're a very strongly Republican state these days, even though we used to be Democratic. Wind has just been phenomenal in Texas, the way it has grown, and it's had very little to do with the government. Wind reached a point where it was extremely competitive economically, and it took off. In Texas, if it makes economic sense, it happens.
We're talking to Fred Beach from the University of Texas, Austin, looking at renewable energy plans by state governments. As he says, they, of course, don't have full control over such things. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you done rooftop solar at your place here in Wisconsin or in a neighboring state? What kind of regulations, what kind of rules did you encounter? What kind of changes do you want to see when it comes to the state's energy policies? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, here in Wisconsin, Fred, we have this this plan, this guideline from Governor Evers. A lot of the practical steps would have to be, you know, involve the legislature probably. As you look at what you're seeing from the governor's office here, what do you make of it?
It's 170 pages that doesn't say much.
How so?
Just some aspirational goals and objectives, but very little on how things are going to evolve. I mean, Wisconsin's in a very difficult position. You have very little wind resource. You have very little solar resource. You're heavily dependent on coal and natural gas in the electricity sector. And I see nothing in that 170 pages speaking to how that's going to change or how it should change, other than it should change.
Well, with wind, for example, we've got neighbors like Iowa, according to the Department of Energy, getting a big chunk of their energy, their electricity, I should say, from wind, over 50%. Wisconsin's not that different than Iowa. Why do you see potential at least for growth in a state like Wisconsin?
Absolutely. I mean, Wisconsin does not have the equivalent wind resource of Iowa, but you do have Lake Michigan, which has excellent wind resource just a few miles offshore. Honestly, I am a little surprised personally that the Wisconsin has not taken greater advantage of the wind resource of the lake and built some significant offshore wind out there. That may have somewhat to do with the fact that, again, you don't have a deregulated market. A couple of very large power providers determine somewhat independently what they offer.
Do you think the state should play a role in saying, yeah, we want to wean ourselves off of coal in particular and then natural gas to fill in the blank with whatever works in the state? Do you see a significant role for the state in charting that course?
I think the best thing the state can do is set standards. And throughout that 170 pages, the plan, the standards I see that the state is aspiring to is low carbon, low emissions. If you want to influence people's behavior, one way to influence their behavior is place a tax on those high fossil fuel, high carbon sources of energy. Give people an incentive to do something different. That's kind of like that's a stick, not a carrot, but sticks often tend to work better than carrots.
Do you see carrots that might be tasty enough to work?
You know, the best carrot out there to encourage people, if you want to see more rooftop solar, is do a decent net metering plan for people who do it. But there's been huge pushback against that, not only in your state, but in many others around the country, primarily driven by the utilities.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Mac is with us in Milwaukee. Mac, hi.
Hi. I think it's valuable to push back on the narrative that consumer choice is the driving or even only factor in fighting these things. To a huge extent, when we leave everything up to the market, that's essentially allowing the market and the large companies to control it to dictate our actions, like using the example of transportation. If I'd like to get somewhere in America, if I'd like to have a job, I need to drive a car because there is no government public alternative. I need to buy a car from a private company, put gas in it, and drive somewhere. Like, we subsidize the gas companies and clear out a market for them, and that's how capitalism historically has worked. I think we need strong government regulation and intervention to get these things done.
Mac,
would be my comment.
Mac, thanks for the call. Fred, what do you think?
I agree with the regulation part. Place a carbon tax. Tax gasoline more heavily. If you want to get to work, as you mentioned, in a car, which is hard to do without a car, buy an electric car. And it would be much, it's already economically to your advantage to do so. And yet we see very low penetration so far in the United States.
Thanks for that call, Mac. Governor Evers' plan also involves hoping for more use of electric vehicles in Wisconsin, both by the government and by individual consumers, maybe like Mac. Do you see a policy device, if that is the goal, to help make that happen?
I don't think a policy device is necessary at this point. Electric cars are actually a better economic choice than fossil fuel vehicles at this point. And in fact, even if, you know, we could wave a magic wand and all folks in your state were driving electric cars tomorrow, it would make your situation even worse because the vast majority of your electricity comes from natural gas and coal.
We're talking to Fred Beach about clean energy plans for states. Governor Tony Evers announced Wisconsin's first one of its kind this week. Fred teaches energy, technology, and policy at the University of Texas, Austin. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see more renewable energies like wind and solar in Wisconsin? If so, how do you think we should get there? Should we have more nuclear in the mix? Just one active plant right now? Do you want to see wind turbines in your community? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Fred Beach. He teaches energy, technology, and policy at the University of Texas, Austin. We're talking about Wisconsin and other states' clean energy plans, detailed and precise, or vague and aspirational. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What would you like to see Wisconsin pursue when it comes to energy policy over the next couple few decades? Are you doing rooftop solar? How does that work out financially for you? Are there things that might make it easier or more difficult for you to make that decision? How about nuclear power? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Fred, we've had conversations on this show in recent months about nuclear power. The case being made that it's a little different these days. You could do smaller plants, more economical plants. Do you see room for that in a renewable energy mix?
I think it's essential, and not so much a renewable energy mix. I mean, what we all really want, I believe, is clean energy, low emission or zero emissions energy. And that is precisely what nuclear is. So, yes, I mean, I'm biased. I'm pro-nuclear. I've served on nuclear-powered submarines and aircraft carriers in the Navy. I'm very familiar and comfortable with the technology. But yes, I think it's an essential part of the energy mix as we try to incorporate more wind and more solar sources.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Rick is with us in Madison. Rick, hi.
Hi. I'm curious. I'm seeing recently that we're building some pretty big solar farms, and we've seen some fairly big wind farms down in especially in Illinois. Why not combine? Why not put windmills on top of solar farms?
Rick, thanks for that call. I imagine it involves where the wind and sun are. Fred, is that something people are doing?
It's very dangerous to do that. We've seen very many cases in the wintertime. You get ice on the blades of wind turbines. And as the blades thaw and that ice comes off, it comes off in a projectile manner. The last thing you want is a large array of solar panels in close proximity to those wind turbines.
That makes sense. Rick, thanks for calling in with the question at 800-642-1234. The governor's plan here also mentions manure digesters. That's something we have some of in Wisconsin. I think there's a bit of that in Texas, too. Do you see this being a significant potential source of electrical generation?
Not a huge source, but an essential part, because anaerobic digesters not only eliminate the methane that would have come from that source and gone into the atmosphere, but use that methane then as a fuel source. So in effect, it's a net zero carbon type way to take what had been a pollutant, the methane, and use it as a fuel source. So no, I think it's a very encouraging thing to see employed at larger scale. It certainly works towards distributed energy solutions.
Let's take another caller now. Matthew is with us in McFarland. Matthew, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call and discussing this very, very important topic. I'm a building science expert, and I'm wondering if the guests can comment on the need for electrification of the building stocks. You know, buildings consume around 40%, and the need to educate future generations of the importance of electrifying buildings and many other things that we use.
And Matthew, just to be clear, you're talking about using electricity instead of, say, natural gas for heat and cooking?
For heating, yes, absolutely. Instead of natural gas for the heating, which is predominantly up in northern climates, which we need to do, but there are alternatives.
Matthew, thanks for the call. Fred, is that part of the picture?
Absolutely. I mean, people think we're highly electrified in this country. Our electrification has only just begun. You're absolutely right. You live in a very cold climate. The majority of your residential, commercial, industrial heating is via natural gas, which is a very efficient way to heat, but it is not very climate conducive. Heating with electricity is possible through advanced heat pumps. It is much cleaner, but again, it depends on where your electricity is coming from. again, if I could wave a magic wand tomorrow and everybody in your state had electric heat pumps for heating their homes, it would be a worse situation because that electricity is coming from coal and natural gas power plants. You would have just made the situation worse. So everything has to work together as we talk about these areas where we can improve. They have to be synergistic with what we're doing in the other areas of the energy economy.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking about clean energy and how to get there with Fred Beach from the University of Texas, Austin. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. We've got Linda with us in Appleton now. Linda, hi.
Hi there. Yes, I know there's lots of different types of electrical cars coming out, and I'm wondering if there's a way to have like a universal public, you know, plug-in for all the different types of electrical cars. I think that's about it. Thank you.
Linda, thanks.
Every electric car I know of can plug in to standard 115-volt household power. I've owned an electric car for 15 years. I've got nothing fancy in my garage. I just plug it into the standard 115-volt outlet. So there is a standard. It's called the U.S. Electric Grid. What I think you're referring to are some of the other high power charging options. And yes, there are basically two standards that exist right now, Tesla and not Tesla. But there are adapters that can make those work in either option.
Thanks for that call, Linda. Another question ongoing here in Wisconsin and around the country is, okay, yeah, you could plug in at home. How about on the road? Range, anxiety, that sort of thing. Are you seeing that problem getting solved?
I don't see range anxiety as being a problem. I have yet to meet somebody who actually owns and operates an electric car who has range anxiety. 90% of American miles traveled are commuting, and we 90% of those miles are trips of 30 miles or less. So the whole concept of, oh, but I wanted to be able to travel coast to coast, that is such a niche, marginal area of the operation of most automobiles that it's pretty insignificant. So it just bothers me that we get so wrapped up over that concept, which really isn't a problem.
Thanks again for the call, Laura. We'll go to Laura now in Twin Lakes. Laura, hi.
Hi. My question, thank you for taking my call on Happy Earth Day. And my question or comment is if there is any research ongoing as to, when a vehicle moves, it generates wind. And there is the sun to create solar power. So I'm picturing a car with a solar panel and basically a generation of energy from the wind that the vehicle actually creates as it moves. Huh. And that can help recharge the vehicle, you know, kind of, you know what I'm saying?
I gotcha, Laura. I never really thought about that. I know some electric vehicles use, when you're braking, I think they generate electricity. Can we use that to the movement of the air or movement through the air and the tops of our cars for solar?
Interesting idea. Unfortunately, as a car moves through the atmosphere, the air, it's actually that resistance, that wind resistance, that air resistance we're fighting against. Mm-hmm. So a car doesn't actually generate on a net basis wind or movement of the air. It only displaces the air as it moves through it, and the air comes back together behind it. What you kind of portrayed actually would have been a perpetual motion machine, fundamentally. So, I mean,
yeah, why don't
it's
we do
an
those?
Interesting idea.
No, just kidding.
Yeah, that'd be nice too. But certainly, I see more and more applications of actually putting solar on the roofs and hoods of cars. And even though it seems insignificant, if your car is sitting in the sun in a parking lot for 8 hours while you're at work, that can add a significant amount of range to your car.
Thanks again for that call. Now, I know we talk a lot about wind and solar and nuclear. Are there energy sources or energy storage technologies on the horizon, Fred, that you're watching for that, you know, might not perpetually be 10 years away, but could actually be something we see sooner than that?
One that's ready today and that can be deployed at large scale nationwide is geothermal. It's old technology. We've been drilling holes in the Earth's crust in this country for hundreds of years. And there's a lot of hot water down there. So I think low temperature geothermal is a very promising source of electricity generation that could be employed quite rapidly across the U.S.
Let's go back to our callers. Jim is with us in River Falls. Hi, Jim.
Hi, thanks for taking my comments. So just a couple things. I have like 5 kW of photovoltaics that I added, and also, I've got a geothermal heat pump, so that's help tremendously as far as, you know, not using a lot of power. And I just wish the government would have more incentives and tax rebates for that. I think a lot of those programs have been cut out. So, I mean, that would help people with their budgets quite a bit too, if everybody could put those on their home. Or, you know, geothermal heat pumps are great as far as being very efficient.
Jim, thanks for the call. We just have a few moments left. Fred, Jim would like to see incentives for people to do what he's doing, geothermal heat pumps and some photovoltaic cells.
Again, that's a way for the government to encourage what we want with those kind of incentives. We've renewed the solar PV incentive a couple of times now, but it, like many incentives, it has a phase out to it unless Congress keeps renewing it. And I think in this case, Congress should.
Thanks for that call. Fred, just in our last few moments, if you had one message for, I don't know, a Midwestern governor who wants to have a cleaner energy profile in their state, what would it be?
Tax gasoline.
Straightforward. Fred, thanks again for joining us today.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Fred Beach, the professor who teaches energy, technology, and policy at the University of Texas, Austin. We talked to them today about Wisconsin's new clean energy plan, how it compares with what some other states have in the works, and you can keep sharing your thoughts, your comments, maybe your own experiences. You can email ideas@WPR.org, or you can always tweet us at Central Time WPR. Again, that's at Central Time WPR.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, to find a way out of war, we may need to look back into history and think about why wars start in the first place. We'll talk with the author of the new book, Why We Fight, about the roots of armed conflict and the path to finding peace.
And we'll meet a Waukesha man who's in his 50th year of collecting vintage beer cans with his family, classic Wisconsin collection. We'll find out how he got started and hear about some favorite finds. Hey, if you do this too, send pictures. Email centraltime@wpr.org. That's centraltime@wpr.org. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time.
Coming up after the news, we talk to a financial coach about how to be less anxious and more hopeful about our personal finances. I'm Dean Knetter.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
It's Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we're cooking up some brownies for Food Friday. Whether you like them fudgy or cakey, we'll cover it all with the author of a new cookbook all about brownies.
First, when you hear the phrase personal finance, what comes to mind? For our next guest, the answer isn't stress or pulling my hair out or mountains of debt. It's actually hope.
It can make us anxious when we think about managing our money in the short or long term.
But our guest says that the anxiety just makes things worse. She wants to teach us how to tackle the fear and the dread and harness hope to make personal finance manageable.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What stresses you out most about managing your finances? Does the stress and anxiety keep you from managing your money? How do you handle the anxiety? Have you found ways to be more positive in the ways that you handle saving, paying off debt, and more? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Emily Birkin is a financial coach and co-author of the book Stacked, Your Super Serious Guide to Modern Money Management. She'll be speaking at the Bayshore Barnes & Noble in Milwaukee tomorrow at 1:30 p.m. She's also giving talks at the Wauwatosa Public Library on Sunday and at Mystery to Me in Madison next Tuesday. Emily, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Emily, I know a big part of your writing and your work is making personal finance a more positive experience to people. I'm curious, what made you zero in on hopefulness as an important part of that?
I can remember talking to a friend several years ago, because I've been writing about money for over a decade now, and was saying, making this joke saying that his retirement plan is just assuming that climate change is going to make retirement impossible. You know, the oceans will rise, the temperatures will rise, you know, everything will be chaos and there's no way he's going to retire. And that's his retirement plan. And he was saying it in a way to be funny. You know, this was not, you know, defeatist or anything like that. He really was making a joke. But there's a kernel of truth in that joke. And I remember being very saddened by this joke. And I've seen other people repeat it. And I realized that what worried me about it was that it was showing a lack of hope. And so the obvious lack of hope is about climate change. You know, this friend of mine is, you know, feeling cynical about our ability to make changes to improve things in the world. But there was also a lack of hope in terms of his ability to navigate a financial system that is confusing and opaque and feels overwhelming. And I realized that having hope, not only for your own personal situation and saying, you know what, this is like my retirement plan. I don't understand what I'm doing, but I believe, I hope that I can master this and provide myself with a future that I want to live in. That is not only makes for a better situation for your personal life, but it also means that you're doing the work on a day-to-day basis to improve things for climate change as well. So if you are saying, I don't feel hope about this, then you're not going to take the small efforts that you can do to improve your own situation and improve the greater situation. And that's whether that's, you know, a big, difficult problems like climate change, like, you know, warfare, I mean, hunger, I mean, all of those things. If you say, like, this is inevitable, there's no way we're around it, you kind of lose the opportunity to take some responsibility for the little portion that you could do. And then it also means that you are not feeling the hope to make things better for yourself. So hope is often kind of denigrated as naive or unserious. I know that I have always been a very optimistic and hopeful person, and there have been times where people will kind of act as though that means I don't really know what's going on. I find there's a similar thing happens when, because my new book, Stacked Your Super Serious Guide to Modern Money Management, takes a very humorous and lighthearted tone. And there's this sense with humor as well, that if something is humorous, then it can't be serious. And in both cases, I don't think that that's correct. I think that when you take something seriously, you have hope, you look at it with humor, you are poised to be in a better position to actually affect the change that you care deeply about, as opposed to thinking that to be serious, you need to be cynical.
And I think a lot of us have probably heard some version of your friend's comment,
yes,
either said or heard things like, I'll never be able to retire or own a house, that's just a pipe dream. When we kind of throw up our hands and think that way, how does that translate into some negative financial decisions?
So when you're thinking, you know, there's no way I'll ever retire, then you don't do the very little things that you can do. So I worked with a woman once who said, you know, I'm not bothering to save for retirement because I want to enjoy the money now when I'm young. And I remember at the time thinking, like, well, I can't slap her silly, we're at work. But I was thinking, like, she was looking at this as this huge thing that she was going to have to give something up, and it was going to make things tough for her now, and she couldn't connect with her older self who was going to need this money. And so she was giving up the opportunity of saying, like, you know what, I can't afford much, but I can send $25 a week into my 401k. You know, I can't afford much, but I can, you know, when I get my tax refund, put half of it into 401k or an IRA. And so hope gives you the space to find little solutions. And when it comes to any major undertaking, it's not one big push. You know, it's not a movie where you're going to get the group together and you're going to fight Thanos and everything's going to be fixed at the end. It's lots and lots and lots of little decisions that add up and compound over time. And so having hope is the way that you open up yourself to see these little decisions and these opportunities in the small moments to say, you know what, I have $500 I wasn't expecting. I can put $300 of it in my 401k. Or you know what, I got a raise. If I plan on 1% of it going to my 401k, that is going to make a difference. Whereas if you're thinking there's no way I can do this, you will never make those decisions.
We're talking to Emily Guy Birkin right now, financial coach and co-author of the book Stacked, Your Super Serious Guide to Modern Money Management. Emily, something you write about in your book, a red flag that you mention is avoiding financial information because it might put a damper on your day. I know I've been there too. A deadline is looming. I need to think about something. I feel that dread and that tension coming up. But in the end, information is power, and having those numbers in front of you and understanding them is helpful. Can you talk about the types of information that we should be willing to look at and plan with?
So there's a lot of information that we would prefer not to think about. And so, you know, you often see this with money where people are like, oh my goodness, I don't even want to look at my bank balance. I don't want to look at my credit card balance. I don't want to look at, you know, what my investments have done as things have been a roller coaster recently. And it's understandable we have that. We also have this similar thing where, you know, probably a lot of us recently, as we're, you know, finally kind of coming out of the pandemic somewhat, we're like, I don't want to step on a scale after all the pandemic snacking I've been doing. Or even if you weren't able to go to the dentist for 10 years, like, I do not want to go to the dentist and find out what's wrong. The problem is the information is there whether or not you know it. You know, like the cavities are there, whether or not you know they're there. The you know, a little extra padding is there, whether or not you know the exact number. And your bank balance, your credit card balance, what's going on with your investments, that's there, whether or not you know it. And it is always better to have information and make decisions from a place of knowledge than to continue to, you know, just pull the wool over your own eyes and pretend it's not there. And so it may take some psyching up to do to get to the point where you're like, okay, I'm ready. But recognizing that even the act of like, I don't want to know this, saying like, you know what, I'm just going to go look. I'll take 3 minutes to look what's going on with my bank balance. Now, generally what's going to happen is that's going to activate you to do something, because you look at your bank balance and you're like, oh my goodness, that I have to, you know, I don't have enough to cover rent. Where can I get that? And you start answering questions. But when you say to yourself, I'm just going to look, going to look for 3 minutes. If there's no problems, I can close it again. That releases you of the sense that you have to like fix something huge, which is why it's scary to get this information. You know, release yourself of that sense that it is up to you to fix everything all at once. You're just getting information. And having that information in your head at moving forward is going to be helpful. And it gets a lot easier to check that information over and over again once you've kind of ripped that Band-Aid off the first time.
We're talking to Wisconsin-based financial coach Emily Guy Birkin about how to feel less dread and more hope when it comes to personal finance.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have any tips for making big money decisions, how to tackle debt, how to invest, making those decisions easier? How did you manage stress and anxiety when it comes to personal finances? Have you had those moments, like Emily was talking about, where you just didn't want to see those numbers? How did you get past that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Dean Kinetter. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with financial coach Emily Guy Birkin about how to feel more hopeful when it comes to your finances.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you have a moment in your life where you confronted your finances, figured out how to try to get them into order, maybe overcame that fear and anxiety? Or do you have a question about how to do that right now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And let's take a caller. We have John with us in Sauk City. Hi, John.
Oh, hi. How you doing?
Good. How are you? What do you want to bring up?
Good. Well, I was just listening, and I remembered this little anecdote from one of my college professors in a calculus class, and he had said, we were probably talking about compound interest or something. And he said, it's easy to make your kids rich. And, you know, his point was that, you know, invest early and let that compounding, you know, build over time. Sure. And I just thought that was an interesting little anecdote.
Absolutely. John, thanks for the call. And Emily, something you mentioned in your writing on being hopeful with personal finance is that this is also kind of a responsibility to ourselves and others in our family, maybe like our children, to start planning mm-hmm. for the future.
To John's point, like one of the things that there's an adage that, you know, the best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago. The second best time is right now. Hmm. And I'm thinking about when you are hopeful for the future, that's when you plant trees. When you're hopeful for the future, that's when you put money in a 529 for your children in a 401k. And that allows you to take advantage of that kind of compound interest. And I think of hope as a responsibility, because hopelessness allows us to say, there's nothing I can do, so I won't do anything. Now, when people feel hopeless, one of the things I want to be very careful about is, you know, when you feel hopeless, I don't want, you know, someone coming along saying, like, you're doing it wrong. You should feel hope. I want people to more think about, like, why are they feeling hopeless? What control do they have over that feeling? And what can they do to kind of reclaim that hope? And not only when I talk about responsibility, not only in the sense of like, that's our responsibility to our future selves and to our children and things like that, but also in the sense that it gives you, agency again. You know, you have a responsibility. You have agency to make this change and bring about the world you want to live in, whether that's, you know, in a personal sense and creating the financial world that you want your family to experience, but also in the much more global sense, in what kind of community do you want to live in? What kind of world do you want to live in? And are you doing little things on a daily basis that can compound to help bring that about, rather than allowing yourself to be overwhelmed by hopelessness?
And one area in particular that I think can feel especially hopeless or intimidating for people right now is the housing market. In a lot of places, mm-hmm. housing prices are pretty high. And if you're planning on buying a house or maybe starting a family, that can seem like a heavy lift. I'm wondering, Emily, what advice you have for people in that situation that want a house but are a little intimidated right now?
So things are really nuts right now. I mean, there's a very good reason why people may feel intimidated. You know, we're seeing these housing prices just go through the roof. And, you know, people are getting priced out of houses. And you're also seeing houses selling with these ridiculous situations. There was something that went viral the other day. There was a house that comes with a person in the basement.
Oh my goodness.
the new owner will have to evict them because the seller is like, I don't even want to deal with this tenant who I can't evict. And so, yeah, of course, that's going to be really overwhelming. And so one of the things that I think is important is for people to remember the right house at the right price will come along at the right time for the vast majority of people. So if it's not the right price, then it's not the right house, and this is not the right time, you know? So it is okay for you to continue to rent and economize in other places while you set money aside for, you know, to own a home later, or focus on other parts of your life, and recognize that you're not in a race. There is no finish line that you're trying to get to, like, all right, I got it. And I got everything in the right order. I got the marriage, then the house, then the babies, then, you know, and all of that. Recognize that you can do things out of order, quote unquote, and you can wait for the right home at the right price at the right time when you're in the right financial place. And, you know, you're in the right place in terms of your career and where you are settling and all of those things. One of the reasons why the housing market can get so overwhelming is that it is much like the stock market in that it ebbs and flows, and people will kind of jump on things because they see, oh, it's hot right now, or there is a lot of demand right now. Now, obviously, it's not quite that simple. But for people who are just looking to get into housing right now, if you're okay, you know, where you are in your apartment, or even if you want to upgrade to a different rental or something like that, there's no rush. There is no reason that you have to get a house right now.
We're talking with financial coach Emily Guy Birkin right now about the value of being hopeful in our personal financial planning. And I want to go back to the phones now at 800-642-1234. We've got Terry in Milwaukee with us. Hi, Terry.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon. I wanted to tell a short story about the importance of investing when you're young. Back in 1972 and 73, I worked as a police officer for a smaller department in southwestern Wisconsin. I was there for 2 years. I left there, and now I'm 71 years old. Last year, I got a call from the state retirement fund that they've been searching for me because I have money in the fund. I asked them, how do you figure? They said, well, you worked for the police department in southwestern Wisconsin in 1972 and 73, correct? I said, yes. The woman said, did you know that they were putting money in a retirement fund for you for those 2 years? I said, no, I had no idea. They never told me that. I said, how much did they put in? She said, $356. My comment to her was, why are you trying to reach me? It seems like you're spending a lot of time and money for $356. She said, sir, that money was compounded every year. We kept investing it. You have $52,000 in that account today.
Wow.
I was just absolutely flabbergasted. When I hung up the phone with her, I called all of my grandchildren. I told them, start investing now.
Wow. Terry, I'm glad that worked out for you, and thank you for sharing that with us. Emily, that sounds like a great example of a little goes a long way.
It really is. That's an amazing story. I love hearing that. Something that I wish more of us understood younger is how the effect of compounding works over time. I can recall my ninth grade social studies teacher, Mr. Bosley, tried to teach us that. And he had us take the example of, and he chose two kids from the class as an example, and he just happened to pick me as one of them, saying like, okay, so Emily starts working at age 18, and she puts aside $500 a year until she turns 40. And keeps it invested at X percentage per year. And then her classmate Joe starts investing at age 40, keeps investing all the way, and he's investing $1,000, and keeps investing until age 65. And they both retire at age 65, and Emily has more money than Joe. Because of the way compounding works. And I remember that lesson, but I don't remember the urgency of it. You know, that was something I like, it was kind of in the back of my head, like, yeah, starting early is important. But it seems like because of the way that our brains are wired, we often don't really understand the urgency of it until we get to a point where we're like, oh, I should have done that yesterday. And so that's something I try to tell people, you know, like if all you can do is 10 bucks every pay period, do it, because 10 years from now, it's going to be worth so much more than the 10 bucks that you lost out of your each paycheck. But we have trouble seeing how that works, in foresight. You know, it's in hindsight that it's like Terry's story like that. It's much easier to see in hindsight than it is to see moving forward.
And Emily, in our last few moments, I know you and your co-author are on tour right now talking with folks about Stacked. Where can people in Wisconsin see you?
So I am going to be at the Bayshore Barnes & Noble in Milwaukee tomorrow, Saturday at 1:30 p.m. I will be at the Wauwatosa Library on Sunday at 1 p.m. And then we will be in Madison at Mystery to Me Bookstore on Tuesday. And I apologize, I'm blanking on exactly when. I believe it's at 6:30 p.m. but we are having these wonderful conversations. There's a lot of laughter, a lot of good financial advice, and you get to see my co-author and I banter and really enjoy ourselves meeting all of you.
Well, Emily, thank you for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Emily Guy Birkin is a financial coach based in Wisconsin and co-author of the book Stacked, Your Super Serious Guide to Modern Money Management.
Coming up after the news, think outside the box of brownie mix on Food Friday. We'll learn how baking brownies from scratch is easier and more creative than you might have thought. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Dean Kinetter. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.